Hello, I'm Sanjeev Bhaskar. I played King Arthur in Monty Python's Spamalot. Well, it's not really about me. But over the next hour, I'm going to tell you everything you need to know about what is probably the greatest comedy film ever made.
Brian, the babe they call Brian.
What have the Romans ever done for us?
I was blind and now I can see.
You're all individuals.
Yes, we're all individuals!
I'm Brian and so's my wife!
Now you listen here! He's not the bazaar, he's a very naughty boy!
It's 30 years since Monty Python's The Life of Brian first hit our screens, and it's been topping countless polls as the best comedy film ever since. No one had made such a comedy about biblical times before. It was the most controversial film of its time. Denounced by religious groups across the world, it was banned from some cinema screens, and it all came about with a little help from a former Beatle.
Well, it was really the Python film. Just that was the reason, really, you started, just to try and help get Life of Brian made.
It was the sort of things, I say, that at Cambridge the footlights did on a damp Tuesday afternoon.
400 years ago, we would have been burnt for this film. Now, I'm suggesting that we've made an advance.
Well, of course, here, the banning meant that we put more bums on the seats.
There had been four series of Monty Python's Flying Circus since the six got together in 1969. Dead parrots, cross-dressing lumberjacks, silly walks, nudge, nudge. I remember watching the Flying Circus growing up in the 70s, and when we started writing Goodness Gracious Me, quoting Monty Python lines is what bonded us together. It had a huge influence on my own comedy. The Pythons' first film was And Now for Something Completely Different, a compilation of their TV sketches, and this was followed by The Holy Grail.
Camelot! Camelot! Camelot!
It's only a model.
Co-directed by the two Terrys, Jones and Gilliam, it proved conclusively that there really were coconuts in Arthurian England.
We're knights of the round table, we dance where we're able. We do routines, we call a scene, to footwork impeccable. We dine well here in Camelot, we eat ham and jam and spam a lot.
Years later, Eric Idle based his Tony Award-winning musical Spamalot on the Holy Grail, and I got to perform some immortal Python material as King Arthur in the West End production. Quite a few times, and I got quite great ovations for it. But anyway, the Python's next film came about thanks to a lot of Dutch beer. Eric Idle and Terry Gilliam.
Terry Gilliam and I were in Amsterdam for the opening of Holy Grail. And Terry and I went out to a small bar and got completely legless.
And Eric came up with the idea of a film called Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory. And we all fell about laughing, and that was the beginning of all of this.
And in we started to do these jokes about Christ, because it was taken, the idea of being that Christ is a carpenter, and these idiots have put up the very bad join at the bottom of the cross, so he keeps falling face forward into the mud.
Michael Palin and John Cleese confessed all in front of a chat show audience in 1979.
And we were still keen to do a historical film. I said, yeah, more fun dressing up and all that. We'd done the Bowler Hatted City Gents on Python. And I think it was Eric who came up with this title out of the blue called Jesus Christ, Lust for Glory. and I must admit that when we started talking about it, we actually explored the idea of doing a comedy film about Jesus, you know, with all the jokes about someone trying to book a table for 12 at the Last Supper. Sorry, sir, you know, Saturday night I'll do you 3-4s. Come in tomorrow, no, it's got to be tonight, and all those jokes.
We all started writing about around the edges, all the people who'd arrived 5 minutes after the miracle had been done. No, which is as bad as being 2,000 years late. The point is, if you didn't see it, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're 5 minutes late or whatever. Actually, we did have the idea that he was the 13th disciple, didn't we? A sort of slight hanger-on.
Yes. Yes,
that's right. He was going to write a gospel, but he was always late.
When we actually started working on...
Terry Jones, speaking on Desert Island Discs in the 80s.
I think we all very quickly came to the opinion that Christ was a very good bloke saying a lot of very good things that we all agreed with. And the humour wasn't in Christ at all. The humour was in the way in which somebody can come down, say things which are true and real, and then for the next 2,000 years, people go ahead fighting and killing each other because they can't agree on what this good person has said.
The characters we like to portray in Python are failures, are dim, are idiotic, are sort of incapable in one way or another. Jesus was a straight, direct man, so making very good sense. And so we decided that we'd be very... sort of just a rather shallow film, just about Jesus, so we got Brian in.
I was originally rather against doing a biblical film because I thought the costumes would be so boring.
Director of Hollywood epics Cecil B. DeMille once said, "Give me 2 pages of the Bible and I'll give you a picture." The Pythons took a slightly different approach.
We spent a couple of mornings just looking at biblical epics, the greatest story ever told, Ben-Hur, things like that. After a while, you realise that everybody spoke in the same way, with a feeling of great reverence and awe that they were living at this time.
One day we hear this man has cured a cripple. Another day changed water into wine.
That isn't all. Walked on water.
Obviously so silly. So I just said, well, you know, just the fact that we're going to be speaking in normal voices or silly voices is going to be kind of quite radical for a biblical film anyway.
I think we're just approaching it from a different way, and you get a lot of laughs from people who say, God, they're right, it can't have been quite so stuffy and stuck up.
Because Python was very free-form and very stupid, the stuff we're doing is so stupid, basically, a lot of the time, you want to have a very structured and very recognisable world in which to operate.
They hit on the idea of Brian, an ordinary man who just happened to be living at the same time as Christ and who is accidentally mistaken for a messiah. Well, it could happen to anyone. It was time to exercise their Oxbridge research skills. Michael Palin.
I can remember we were sort of rather like scholars wrestling with the ancient texts and trying to insert comedy into them. You would get to a certain level, we've got the scene in the garden, the crucifixion, all these things. How can you possibly, you know, make jokes about these? And then we went all the way back, usually to historical reference points, to actually looking at what would have happened at that time in this sort of environment.
People start throwing out ideas, and you can never remember who said what, and that's what's really the strength of Python, is that they'll take an idea and it'll just start to float, and it'll go off in any direction, and it's almost like automatic writing.
We just started writing like we'd always written, just sort of everybody writing odd scenes, so we could see what was funny.
About the time the Pythons were starting to write The Life of Brian, Mary Whitehouse, secretary of the National Viewers and Listeners Association, was bringing a private prosecution against Gay News. The paper had published a poem involving Christ, which she believed to be blasphemous, and she was reviving Britain's ancient blasphemy law to prove it. In 1977, Whitehouse won the action.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey.
In such a climate, the Pythons informally sought the opinion of a canon of St. George's, Windsor Castle. He read the script and wrote back.
It seems clear to me the script is not meant to be blasphemous and that it is extracting the maximum comedy out of false religion and religious illusions.
Suitably reassured, with several drafts of the screenplay already written, in early 1978 the Pythons made the ultimate artistic sacrifice and departed for a gruelling working trip with no extracurricular pleasures.
Of course, course, I was actually totally against going to Barbados. I thought this is really a silly thing to do. But in fact, to get everybody away from the phones and to get everybody away from other commitments was actually to isolate us in a house altogether. It was a really good idea, actually. It worked out well. The trip just enabled us to focus on the screenplay and actually get it into a better shape.
And it was really successful. We had 2 weeks of it. It was good fun. And Keith Moon came and followed us there. And it was like a little boy. He'd wait on the beach for us to finish work. Because we still did the office hours, being Python. We still did, 9 till 12, then we'll do from 1:30 till 5:30. And Keith Moon would wait on the beach to play with us as we came out of school.
In their luxurious beachside villa, with visitors like Mick Jagger and Des O'Connor popping round in the evening for a game of charades. Now there's an image. It's a wonder they got any work done. But they did. Terry Jones.
A lot of the themes came out of the thing, you know, think for yourselves and don't do what everybody tells you, somebody tells you to do. It was the feeling of the script all falling into place.
But there was just one question. Why Brian? Michael Palin and John Cleese in that 1979 chat show.
I don't know. We've always used Brian in Python to portray a certain sort of character, a fairly anonymous, and I apologise to anyone called Brian. John's in a sketch about a footballer being interviewed in one of the very early Python shows, and it was all, Brian.
Yeah,
there's a ball in the back
right.
of the net, Brian.
I'm opening a boutique, Brian.
But it's one of the funny names, isn't it? It's like Trevor and Kevin. I mean, they're just funny.
EMI had offered to finance the film, but just days before production was to start, Lord Delphont, the chair of EMI, finally got round to reading the script. Fearing it was blasphemous, he pulled the plug.
And we were a bit shocked because, we were already in preparation.
John Goldstone, the film's producer, took the news on the chin.
You know, I guess it was because the script was so wonderful and the feeling that this film would happen come what may, that we soldiered on, and Eric and I had various contacts in America.
They went to a round of meetings in New York and L.A., but couldn't get the film financed.
And then Eric said, George Harrison has always been a great fan. Why don't we try him? Eric was quite friendly with him, and he lived in Los Angeles. So we sent a script to his house and met him a couple of days later. And George said, I'll put up all the money for this. I was a bit sceptical. Musicians are all a bit flaky, you know. You never quite know whether they fully understand what they're getting into. But he was serious about it.
And so Handmade Films was born. George Harrison in a 1985 interview.
So I said, I don't know, as a Python fan, I'd certainly like to see it made. I asked my manager, can you think of how to get them the money? And he came back to me in a week. He said, I think I know how we could do it. We'll be the producers. And so we mortgaged all our companies and everything, borrowed the money from the bank and did it. And fortunately, it made the money back, at least. I think we actually made some money on that, which then went in towards Time Bandits. We originally started just as the one-off, but then I think Dennis sort of liked the idea. You know, I thought, hey, this film business sounds good. So, I just sort of rolled along with it.
Harrison and his then-business manager, Dennis O'Brien, put up $4 million to make the film.
I know at that period was the recession and the oil problems and everybody was broke and it was a difficult time.
Terry Jones.
I guess you could say it was the most expensive cinema seat ever.
It was a very constructive series of events that no one has any regrets about.
John Goldstone again.
We were going to shoot it in April, but the delay meant that we would have to put it off to the autumn because it would have been too hot to go to Tunisia, where we decided to do it.
Autumn 1978. The shoot was something of a reunion for the Pythons, who were evidently in high spirits. BBC documentary maker Ian Johnston captured them on set in Monastir.
Terry Gwilym.
Oh, he's here too.
No, Gillingham.
Gillingham.
Sorry.
This is the pre-take chat, banter that goes on amongst the actors before the take. There's a lot of nerves at this point. Some of the chaps are actually damp in the knickers, but...
The two Terrys had co-directed The Holy Grail, but for the life of Brian, Terry Gilliam stuck to the art direction.
My feeling on the last one was that with two of us directing, we're always shouting. Both of us run on adrenaline, really, and we're both shouting madly. And the crew, I found it very confusing for the crew. I think the crew found it that way, too. And dictatorship is really important in filmmaking in a way. It really needs one voice, really, to hold it together.
I think Terry hadn't really enjoyed co-directing. I'm a collaborator, so I quite enjoyed it.
Terry Jones speaking today, and here on set 30 years ago.
I'm never conscious of actually doing anything positive. It's only sort of trying to get the camera rolling at the right time, I suppose. Everybody's relying on sort of... They're doing things, performing things, and then saying, was that all right, really? And it's a question of sort of everybody saying, well, yes, we think that was all right, or perhaps you could do this a little bit differently.
Start again.
What dazzles me is the quality of the costume, the design, the look of it. It's absolutely terrific. All those robes, biblical robes, nearly always look the same in all normal biblical films. All these seem, those are very personal. The dirt and the shabbiness is personal to the character.
We wanted it to look like an art film. I don't see any reason why comedy shouldn't be beautiful. I wanted it to look like an epic in some ways.
The sets were adapted from those built for Italian director Franco Zeffirelli's TV epic Jesus of Nazareth. Producer John Goldstein again.
Tarak Ben Ammar, who was the nephew of President Bourguiba, had effectively established a Tunisian film industry around this set. There were some just wonderfully dramatic locations.
But who was going to play what? Eric Idle, always good at those cheeky chappies? Terry Gilliam, anything that involved looking grotesque? John Cleese just had to be Reg, the officious leader of the People's Front of Judea. And Michael Palin? Let's give him some speech impediments. But what about the Virgin Mandy? Mother of Brian.
I think nobody else wanted to do it, so I usually ended up with the parts nobody else wanted to do, really.
Who are you?
We are three wise men.
What?
We are three wise men.
Well, what are you doing creeping out of the car shed at 2 o'clock in the morning? That doesn't sound very wise to me.
We usually wrote the scripts and then did the casting. John was very keen to play Brian. And he was interested in doing a part that went right the way through. And I think the rest of us were rather appalled at the idea of John playing Brian, because we felt that John was invaluable for playing other parts, like the Centurion, and we couldn't really spare him for that.
I was disappointed at the time, but in retrospect, and in fact during the actual filming, I felt very strongly the others had been right, that it was much better that I was playing the funny parts, and the two or three very funny parts, the Centurion and Reg, the terrific part.
And also, I cannot see John doing that part.
Snob tongue, wren's liver, chaffinch brain.
With Graham, it's like, you know, he's not really there acting. He's just sort of, I've got to do this part, so I'll just carry on doing it. And on a big screen, that's a very key thing. It rings true.
In his skullcap and frayed robes, Graham Chapman's performance as Brian is at the heart of the film.
Please listen, I am not the Messiah, do you understand? Honestly!
It's well known Graham Chapman's drinking had been a problem in the past, but by the time The Life of Brian came around, he'd been dry for a while.
He was in very, very good physical shape and very focused. And that was great because he was actually a very fine actor. He was potentially, possibly the best of any of us as an actor. And I thought he was terrific as Brian.
Sun, sea and a generous hospitality budget was a recipe for a happy shoot.
There was such goodwill.
John Goldstone.
And we had this sort of small repertory company with us to play all the other parts. So everybody was playing multiple parts and there was lots of quick costume changes. And yeah, it was a real family out there. Very nice.
We had Terence Baylor, Charles McEwen.
One member of that rep company was Bernard McKenna, an old writing chum of Graham Chapman.
We mainly did know, almost in advance, what main bits we were doing. I knew I was going to be Parvis in charge of crucifixion at the end. But you would suddenly be told, you know, could you do this or could you do that? I'm looking at a copy of the original script here. which has got food stains, wine stains, coffee stains, and it's got all the little inserts that they stick under your door at night, whether it affects you or not, so you stick it into the script. It has the very, very long opening scene about sheep, which was cut out of the film eventually. But this is a treasured possession of mine.
Sue Jones-Davies played Brian's girlfriend, Judith Iscariot. She was on the bus going to the audition when she first read the script.
It was extremely funny. It was hilarious. And I laughed the whole way. I mean, the bus driver actually stopped me at some point and said, "What are you reading? Because you're breaking up there with laughter." And he wished me good luck, and off I went, and I got the audition.
And of course, there was Flying Circus stalwart Carol Cleveland.
I think everyone got on extremely well, and everybody seemed in very good spirits. We had a lot of laughs, a lot more than there had been on the Holy Grail. Well, for a start, the weather was much better. When we were filming Holy Grail, the weather was appalling. It rained every day. It was muddy. It was vile, and the guys were not happy. But this time, the sun was shining, and everyone was having a good time.
Oh, it was great. Everybody would eat together in the big restaurant, and then afterwards you'd be in the bar, and then you'd be outside lolling around the pool, enjoying the sun. And then on a day off, of course, you went and lay on the beach. It was the dream job for me.
In quite a lot of the crowd scenes where I was, as it were, a background artiste, I always made sure that I was near one of the stars, Cleese or Palin, sometimes both, because you'd be in shot.
Carol Cleveland's first appearance was in the Sermon on the Mount scene.
I think it was Blessed Are the Cheesemakers.
What's so special about the cheesemakers?
Well, obviously, it's not meant to be taken literally. It refers to any manufacturers of dairy products.
I play Mrs. Gregory, half of a very posh Roman couple, listening to the sermon. And wallop, I get it. And in the background, you see Michael and I on the ground, and he's punching away at me, and I'm kicking him. And of course, what you don't know is that we are killing ourselves laughing. We are just giggling and giggling.
The dress code for the following scene was beards.
And all I said to my wife was, that piece of halibut was good enough for Jehovah.
I was very, very pleased with the stoning scene.
He said it again!
It was shot on the very first day of the movie, the first day of principal photography. People got very upset about that stoning scene when the film came up. As far as I was concerned, it was all based on very factual stuff.
So factual, the idea of stoning someone for blasphemy was suggested by a chaplain at Windsor who they'd talked to for research. Terry Jones remembers.
And this was one that he came up with. The idea of not being able to say the most holy word, the name of God, was communicated directly to John Graham via the Queen's chaplain.
It's nice to get help with the script from high places. And the scene where Cleese's centurion corrects Brian's Romans go home graffiti is not too far-fetched either.
Romanes eunt domus. People call Romanes, they go the house.
It says Romans go home.
No, it doesn't.
There was indeed simmering resentment towards Roman imperial rule in first century Judea. People were waiting for a messiah, or some kind of revolution to liberate them. The Pythons give a historically accurate picture of the time, with contemporary parallels. Michael Palin.
There were just an awful lot of liberation groups around in the 70s. Everyone was setting up a group somewhere, and they would always be known by a few letters. And they'd all be run very sort of bureaucratically, and with a lot of sort of motions being passed and a certain language which is used here about the way things should be done.
This point of view is very valid, Rick, provided the movement never forgets that it is the inalienable right of every man
or woman
to rid himself
or herself.
Agreed.
Thank you, brother.
Or sister.
What's funny about the revolutionaries and what was funny about the political extremists in London in the 70s is that they can convince themselves of anything. It's what happens when people's intellect becomes completely separated from their emotions.
John tends to want his comedy to be ground-based in thought or in a target.
Let's face it, the only ones who could...
And I think the best example of that is, what have the Romans ever done for us?
But apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, a fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us? Brought peace? Oh, peace! Shut up!
And what he does is to latch onto a kind of cliché thinking and just pillory it mercilessly. And that's why I think John's writing is at its finest.
Brian's graffiti has landed him before Michael Palin's Pontius Pilate, the poster boy of speech impediments.
Now, what is your name?
Jew? Brian, sir.
Brian, eh?
No, Brian.
Bernard McKenna had the misfortune to be one of the Roman guards trying to keep a straight face right to the end of the scene.
We had to start laughing when he gave Bigas Dickus's wife's name.
Incontinentia.
And in the film, it's incontinentia buttocks.
What is all this? I've had enough of this rowdy rebels.
But he changed it every take, so we never knew, the other guard and I, what he was going to say. I remember one of them, he said he has a wife, you know. Do you know what her name is? And we had to shake our heads. And he said, her name is Katya. And we sighed relief, thinking that's not a funny name. And he went, Katya bollocks off. The other trouble is, of course, you've got this big Panavision camera, and behind it you have a large crew, and they're all in hysterics, holding their stomachs, bending, doubled over with laughter, and you must not laugh.
While they're dissolved in hysterics, Brian escapes, chased through the streets, up a tower, into an impossible situation.
The only way out of it was something as impossible as a spaceship, and it just became much funnier, because if we'd stayed within the bounds of the reality of the film, you couldn't do that. But by introducing something like that was, number one, a great pythonic thing to do, and it gave me a chance to pretend to be George Lucas for a brief moment.
And when Graham Chapman wasn't being hotly pursued on set, he was putting his training as a doctor to good use.
He would even hold sort of a surgery on set in the morning, you know, before going on and doing a major scene as Brian. And I was on the same floor as him as well in the hotel, so there was a constant stream of people popping in and out to get various pain-relieving drugs and things.
Back on set, Brian is mistaken for a messiah, pursued by a crowd of devoted followers.
He has given us a show!
The show is the sign! Let us follow his example!
What? So I sort of scurry around in the film as a follower.
Carol Cleveland.
Covered in rags and sores, and I mean, not a glamorous role at all. And suddenly the camera said, cut, cut, and we couldn't think why it was going so well. Apparently, there was something rude going on in the background with a donkey, with two donkeys. I think that they did keep this particular take. So look in the background, you might see some rude things going on with donkeys, if you're lucky. Another thing I remember about that particular sequence was when Spike Milligan arrived.
Spike, quite by accident, was on holiday in the hotel next to us.
Eric Idle.
So we said, you must come and be in a scene, Spike. And he said, all right, okay, fine. So he set aside the morning to come and be in the scene, the shoe scene. Is it a shoe? It is a sign.
So we shoved him in the front of all of us and just left him to improvise.
Yea, he cometh to us like the siege of the grave.
So that was great fun, and I think we did about two or three takes. And we said, well, we'll do one more, and we looked and Spike had disappeared.
He went off in his costume. And so we were driving home later on that night on a coach back to the hotel, and we saw Spike by the side of the road, still in his costume, being pulled over by a Tunisian policeman. And he was arguing and shouting, and he was clearly getting himself into big trouble. So we stopped the coach, and Bernard McKenna got out and said, look, officer, he's with us, neglecting to remind himself that he was dressed as a Roman centurion. It's all right, he's with us. And there's a crowd of idiots dressed in costume. So we did rescue Spike.
Besides Spike Milligan, there was another cameo role by someone rather famous.
George Harrison appears as Mr. Papadopoulos, where he has a beard and nobody ever recognises him. We were determined that he'd have to appear. Served him right, having the least he could do, having paid for all of this.
Sue Jones-Davies has fond memories of playing Judith in that excruciatingly funny morning after scene.
I mean, when I read the script and I saw the context of the nudity, there was no way it was salacious, it was just funny.
Leave that Welsh tart alone!
I don't really want to.
And we were in this cell that was so small that by the time we were lying down, me and Graham Chapman, there was hardly room for the camera to come on top to film us, but it was just fun.
Your son is a born leader. Those people out there are following him because they believe in him, Mrs. Cohen. They believe he can give them hope. Hope of a new life, a new world, a better future!
being that character was very much me at that time, very impatient, very energised.
And of course, this is the scene where, as the crowd of followers throng below Brian's window, his mother delivers the film's most celebrated line.
Now, you listen here! He's not the Messiah! He's a very naughty boy!
You're listening to me, Sanjeev Bhaskar, and this is He's Not the Messiah, He's a Very Naughty Boy, celebrating 30 years of Monty Python's Life of Brian. With Brian back in the Roman cells, Palin's Pontius Pilate attempts to communicate with his imperial subjects to set one of the prisoners free, which presented some technical problems for Terry Jones.
The biggest crowd we had was 500 for the Willis Wodja scene. We thought, how are we going to get a crowd of 500 Tunisians to laugh? So we got along a Tunisian comedian, and he started telling jokes, and of course nobody laughed really. So after about 5 minutes, I said, oh, this is no good. So I said, just tell the crowd to do what I do. So I fell on my back and waggled my legs and arms in the air and laughed hysterically. And the entire audience just fell about and they fell over on their backs, waggled their legs in the air, and this dust went up for them. And it looked absolutely wonderful. But, of course, we weren't turning over. So we did it a second time, but it never looked quite as good as it did the first time.
Willis Wodja!
Sir, we don't have a Wodja, sir.
It was really very, very unsettling to play Pilate to this lot and find them in the end literally rolling over in huge numbers of people just jeering at you. I mean, there's nothing more guaranteed to put you back in your place. The idea of Pilate was that here's a man in a position of great power, you know. He's governor, got the Romans behind him, he's in a position of great authority, but he does have this other strange way of speaking. And yet everybody sort of has to ignore it, and it makes him all the more ridiculous. And once people start laughing, you do get a brilliant form of subversion.
Besides being very good at making Tunisians laugh, director Terry Jones had some novel ways of keeping his cast's attention. Sue Jones-Davies.
He was wonderful because he directed most of it in his costume as the mother. So when it got very hot, he took the dress off. So he just had these boobs that were made of straw hanging there. And it's quite hard to take direction from somebody who looks like that. And of course, the other pythons were just appallingly rude to him a lot of the time and just told him to shut up. And because they all knew each other so well. It was a great, great atmosphere to be working in.
But it was hard some days to remember that Terry was the director, because you have this naked man in a beard, half the time doing his character and half the time telling you that, you know, if you went three paces further back, then it would be better for the three shot that was going to come later. You couldn't quite take it seriously.
I was doing The Hermit in the Hole, where I was just naked. I just had a long beard. And I was directing the crowd scene, and Michael came up behind me and said, Terry, did you realise you're stark naked, don't you?
Of course, Terry always loved to go naked. Who's going to go naked? I will. You know, Terry was always in there for going naked.
Jeffrey Burgon has known Terry Jones since school days. He composed the film's score.
I thought Jeffrey's music was brilliant.
And I think what's funny about it is that they set it all up to look like a proper biblical epic. And then daft things keep happening. And so I thought, I'm going to write proper biblical epic music. And we had the budget, I had a big orchestra, had a choir. I thought, I'm going to sort of do this in the style of all the great biblical epic composers, as far as I can. In fact, there are a lot of quotes, not from Hollywood films. There's some bit of Wagner in there, a bit of Monteverdi, a bit of Mozart. But no one ever noticed, actually. No one's comments on that. When the kings are approaching the stable, I wanted to set that up like it was the real thing. So I had the sort of holy chorus. Trying to get a feeling of anticipation about what was going to happen. And as soon as they get to the stable and they discover it's the wrong one, the music just stops and it's all sort of, you know, daft. But I just had a lot of fun with it.
Back in London, Terry Gilliam was overseeing the music to go with his animated title sequence. Andre Jackman and Dave Howman composed the title song, and it was sung not by Shirley Bassey, but Sonia Jones. The three got together recently to recall the session. Andre Jackman.
Terry Gilliam had this idea about doing this sort of big James Bond style opening. Shirley Bassey is associated with James Bond.
I came up from Wales and I met Andre, who was going to be my pop manager for my pop career.
course, with Sonia being Welsh, we just thought automatically, oh, she's a great singer, she can do it.
And I just said, no, I've never sang like Shirley Bassey. And they said, oh, no, come on, it's only a demo. And that was it. They threw me in at the deep end.
Brian, the babe they called Brian.
I was a teenager.
I think you were about 17.
Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be a demo, and they were going to try and get Shirley Bassey to do it, weren't they?
Well, we did talk about it, but Sonny did such a good job, we felt it wasn't necessary. And in fact, the secret's out now, but yes, Sonny's absolutely right. The song on the film is a demo.
The arrangement was written and played by John Dupre.
And I think I did about 12 trumpet tracks and sort of another 12 French horn tracks and piano and everything, and built it up into this huge Bond-style big band, and staggered out about 11 o'clock at night, totally exhausted. So they played this track back at full volume, you know, and it kind of pinned us to the wall, these sort of banks of trumpets and French horns, you know, there's a huge sound. And everyone went, wow, you know, that's very good. And that was my baptism of fire.
I thought, oh, my God, I've got to say the word pissed here. And that really worried me.
Dave Howman.
She was very, very shy as well. I was very shy and very sheltered, had that sheltered life. So saying those sort of things was kind of very sort of shocking to her.
I said, what does one off the wrist mean? And they fell about laughing. I didn't have a clue. People thought I was a Shirley Bassey impersonator, and they didn't expect me to be sort of Welsh and fair.
I can still see the image of us working it out, and that took all of about 10 minutes.
Back on set, there was just one more scene to film. Michael Palin.
Crucifixion party.
He couldn't avoid the fact that there's a crucifixion at the end in the Bible story. So I think actually Terry and myself did quite a long stint of writing this whole sort of procession and the various characters, basing our sort of comment, if you like, on the fact that crucifixions were not uncommon. In fact, they were very common. In fact, some days there'd be 500 or 600 people crucified in a day. So Jesus was not the only one who was ever put on a cross.
It's kind of a bit chilling to go turn up for a day's filming and find a cross with your name on it. And they had little bicycle seats so you could just perch. But of course, being Python, there was like 30 people being crucified and there were only like 3 ladders. So if you wanted a piss, you know, in between takes, people were like, over here, please, quickly, I gotta get down.
It was uncomfortable. We were tied on.
Carol Cleveland.
Way on top of a hill and it was quite windy. We were getting a bit chilly because most people are only dressed in little togas or loincloths or something.
See, that's about what you have.
There was 3 days of shooting on the cross, and beneath us was a troglodyte house, and this little woman was sweeping her yard all day. Never looked up once to these 30 people being crucified above her head. It was totally bizarre.
Cheer up, Brian. You know what they say? Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse.
Being Python, there was only one possible way to end the film.
I think the idea was to have a song and dance number on the cross was the idea.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on!
Neil Innes of Bonzo Dog Doodah Band and Ruttles fame had worked with the Pythons for years. he made a crucial contribution to the song.
Eric rang me up and said, come and listen to this. I don't think it's quite right. And we went to a studio in Marble Arch. And I listened to the lyrics, and in the verse, you know, it sort of says, when you're chewing on life's gristle, don't worry, give a whistle. You know, I went, stop! You know, there you are. Where's the whistle? And so I just stood there with the headphones on in front of the microphone, and, you know, it just popped into my head then and there. And I did it all the way through to the end of the take, including a bit of improvisation on the end, and that's the bit that went out to Tunisia. And so that was it, one take, and we all went up down the pub.
Just remember that the last laugh is on you, and always look on the bright side of life. Always look on.
We didn't hear it until we were over in Tunisia. When Eric played it to us, I wasn't really very... I didn't really like it particularly, the song. But, of course, it's a brilliant song in the end.
First things happen to see, you know. Always look on the bright side. Look what you've got to lose. You know, you come from nothing, you're going back to nothing. What you lost? Nothing. Always look on
the
right
side of life. The film's world premiere was on the 17th of August, 1979, in New York City. It came out in the same week as Apocalypse Now and The Muppet Movie. Life of Brian was rated an R for restricted.
I thought it was sick. It was marvelous. I just loved it. And it was really great.
I thought it was shocking.
I was born and raised Catholic. I didn't find it offensive at all. But I'm a lapsed Catholic.
That was hilarious, too. I'm sure you'll be
amazed. Outraged religious leaders quickly denounced the film. The first protest came from the Rabbinical Alliance of America, which declared the film foul, disgusting, and blasphemous. Protestant protest from the Lutheran Council described Brian as a profane parody. Not to be outdone, the Catholic Film Monitoring Office made it a sin to see the film.
A group of rabbis and priests held demonstrations over this past weekend, and they were demonstrating against a movie called The Life of Brian. About 250 people gathered in front of the Warner Brothers offices.
The protesters brandished placards reading, Python equals serpent equals Satan. It was big news. Here's Gene Shalit, an American Barry Norman with more puns, on NBC's Today Show.
Ye who would not see the Bible satirized, stay thee at home. And ye who would smile at biblical buffoonery, hie thee hence to a theater nearest you. Just knowest beforehand what thou art getting into. Therefore sayest not that thou art not warned, and others will be saved from your gripes of wrath.
Writer and friend of the Pythons, Robert Hewison, has written an account of the film's controversial life.
When the film was released in America, because of the right to free speech, effectively what you have to face is pressure groups. It was greeted warmly in, say, university towns, but throughout the Bible Belt, then it was constantly being harassed. There were constantly complaints. And effectively what that did was that simply it affected the commercial profitability of the film.
But the controversy in the States generated huge public interest over here. The Life of Brian had its UK premiere in November 1979. It broke box office records in its first week, despite the hymn-singing protesters outside, and it was backed by an ingenious ad campaign.
Hello, my name is Muriel Cleese, and I live in a very nice elderly people's home in Weston-super-Mare. My son John is in the new Monty Python film, Life of Brian. Do hope you'll go and see it, because he's on a percentage, and he said if it doesn't do well, he won't be able to keep me on in the home any longer. So see The Life of Brian now, because I'm 102 years old, and if I have to leave here, it'll kill me.
If you want to help Mrs. Cleese, please go and see Monty Python's Life of Brian. Exclusive presentation at the Plaza from Thursday, November the 8th. Certificate AA.
A delighted Muriel Cleese, she was actually only 80, won an award for that commercial. Terry Gilliam's mum and Michael Palin's dentist also recorded slots.
Now, I said earlier that Woody Allen's Manhattan was the best comedy of the year, and I stick by that, though it did have one pretty close rival. The story of Brian Cohen, a young Jewish boy who happened to be born on the same night...
Barry Norman gave it the thumbs up. But Christian morality campaign group, the Festival of Light, had been lobbying hard against the film to James Furman of the British Board of Film Censors, the organisation responsible for granting film certification. He was naturally cautious when it came to awarding a certificate. Producer of the film, John Goldstone.
What he wanted to be sure in the first place was that the film was not blasphemous. So at least legally, he was clear to give it a AA certificate. So we therefore had to get opinions from... Well, in fact, it turned out to be John Mortimer, who, you know, frankly, just thought it was a brilliant film and was definitely not, in legal terms, blasphemous. And on the basis of that, we got our certificate.
James Furman, the official censor, clarified the judgment in an interview in 1983.
The legal view was that the film was not blasphemous because Brian was quite distinct from Jesus. They're born in adjacent mangers, quite clearly two separate births. And at the first scene after the titles is the Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus, who is delivering the sermon quite straightforwardly and played by a serious actor, is distinct from Brian, who's at the back of the crowd selling sweets. And so he's a comic character at a serious function, as of course always happens throughout history. Great moments in history are not necessarily serious and solemn moments because we don't know at the time they're going to be important historically. And the point of the film was that it's possible to treat biblical times irreverently without treating Jesus irreverently. And that seemed to us to be a fair thing.
As it was released around the country, the film attracted mounting controversy. A lot of it whipped up by the Festival of Light movement led by Mary Whitehouse. Some local authorities chose to exercise their right to ban screenings within their boroughs, like Harrogate. A local councillor there was interviewed about their decision.
Now, you've not actually seen the film,
no,
have you?
No, we haven't.
What reports have you had of it? Where have those reports come from?
The reports have come from the Festival of Light, and they have told us of the attitude of the American Catholic Church and the American Jewish Church.
If you lived in Harrogate, you had to drive 16 miles down the road to Leeds to see the film. And this random regional censorship occurred around the country, from Swansea to Surrey. It was even banned in places that didn't have cinemas. And there was a blanket ban throughout Cornwall. Robert Hewison again.
The cinemas in Exeter did terribly well because all the people from Cornwall who wanted to see the film, and of course, what happens when you try to suppress something is you actually draw attention to it, so there's lots more interest. So coach parties were being got up and happily going up to Exeter to watch the movie.
Many countries banned the film completely, including Ireland and Norway.
There is, of course, great rivalry between Sweden and Norway in all sorts of cultural matters. So, of course, the Swedes delightedly promoted the life of Brian in Sweden by saying, "This film is so funny, it was banned in Norway."
The Pythons did a round of interviews defending their position. Here's John Cleese speaking to Gerald Priestland on the Today programme in 1979.
But we knew, I think, inevitably, that 2%, maybe 3% of the people that saw it would have some kind of offended reaction.
Yeah. What would you actually say to that 2 or 3% now?
Very sorry that you didn't like it. I'm sorry we offended you. That was not the intention. The intention was to be funny.
And one interview from this time has become something of a TV classic. It's when John Cleese and Michael Palin appeared on Tim Rice's chat show Friday night, Saturday morning. Let's be polite and call it an in conversation with the Bishop of Southwark and moral campaigner Malcolm Muggeridge. It was all a bit like a Monty Python sketch.
And our guest reviewers are Malcolm Muggeridge and Mervyn Stockwood, the Bishop of Southwark.
It was the sort of thing, as I say, that...
Mervyn Stockwood.
...the footlights did on a damp Tuesday afternoon.
No, seriously, the problem that we have got is that you think that we're ridiculing Jesus. Mm. And we say, sort of sincerely and truthfully, that is certainly not what we intended to do, and I believe that we're not. What we're saying is take a critical view.
But there's nothing in this little squalid number,
Malcolm Muggeridge,
that could possibly destroy anybody's genuine faith.
No. Did you not feel that, in fact, the people being lampooned were the followers?
Tim Rice.
Rather than Jesus himself?
No, I thought that very strongly.
No, I don't think so.
Michael Palin started to get a bit heated.
Christ is played by an actor, Ken Colley. He speaks the words from the Sermon on the Mount. He's treated absolutely respectfully. The camera then pans away. We go to right to the back of the crowd to someone who shouts, "Speak up," because they cannot hear him. Now, if that utterly undermines one's faith in Christ, then I think your faith cannot be strong.
I started off by saying that this is such a tenth-rate film that I don't believe that it would disturb anybody's faith.
Yes, I know you started with an open mind. I realise that.
You'll get your 30 pieces of silver, I'm quite sure.
Looking back today, Tim Rice remembers it fondly.
It wasn't really a discussion, it was more a slanging match. I personally thought that John and Michael came out of it slightly better than the two old codgers. It was really like going to some of the television debates I'd had with Andrew in America when Jesus Christ Superstar came out 10 years before, in which we were accused by rather strange, semi-deranged elderly people of being blasphemous. Well, the audience, I guess, were 95% on the Python side, even those who hadn't seen the movie, because not many people at that point had seen it. It had only just come out. And I don't think Malcolm Muggeridge or the Bishop did any good for their cause, whatever that was. And it was, in essence, the clash of cultures.
A few years later, Michael Palin had just about recovered.
John Cleese said he's only seen me get angry twice in my life. Once was on that programme, the other time was when I was made to eat mud in one of the Python films.
Years later, on Desert Island Discs, Terry Jones was still defending the film's message to Roy Plumley.
Brian himself wasn't Christ in the end. He was born in the next door manger. But the parallels are there. The parody is the parody on the church. So it's heresy rather than blasphemy.
Well, that's comforting. I hope they've marked that down for you upstairs.
John Cleese.
But I was also surprised by how many people wrote to me in particular. I mean, probably the other Pythons got it too, and said, you know, I'm a Christian and I don't know what this fuss is about, because it seemed to me perfectly clear that you were making fun of the way that some people pretend they're Christians when they're actually not following Christ's teaching. They got it.
30 years on, Nick Baines, Bishop of Croydon, loves the film.
I've seen The Life of Brian dozens of times, and it's always funny. The main thing being that it is the life of Brian, not the life of someone else. That a lot of my mates, either in the church or out of the church, almost know the script by heart. And sometimes you only have to say, you know, one line, and everybody falls about because you know what comes next. You can't read back 30 years ago into something that was a different context. Culturally, this sort of thing wasn't done. You know, it was very daring. But we often do this with things, not just Christians. You know, things move on, you go, well, what was the fuss about?
And while most of the local screening bans were quietly lifted years ago, some towns have only just got around to it.
I suppose I should say I've never seen the film because I live in Aberystwyth and it's been banned for the past 20-odd years.
Earlier this year, Aberystwyth officially lifted its ban on the film. Thanks to the woman who played Brian's feisty girlfriend, Judith, and who until recently held the role of another political firebrand. Plaid Cymru Mayor for Aberystwyth, Sue Jones-Davies.
Yes, we put on a special showing here because it had been banned here, although it had subsequently been shown, but by then the publicity machine just wanted to know that it had been banned. So we just were swept along and we decided we'd have a showing up here at the Arts Centre, the Aberystwyth Arts Centre.
And if the good people of Aberystwyth managed to watch it without needing the smelling salts, then The Life of Brian's official status as a national treasure is surely confirmed. Besides topping every poll as the best ever comedy film, so many lines from it have filtered into our everyday language. References to it pop up in the most unlikely places.
And the dancer's thing said about New Labour is not the usual, what have the Romans ever done for us? You know, like someone I met at the TUC said, what have you ever done for the trade unions? And I said, well, what about the right to union recognition? Or the social chapter, paid holidays, restoration of union rights at GCHQ, an end to blacklisting, information and consultation rights? And he said, yeah, but no one knows about it. And I said, well, try telling them.
Is it me, or did he really have to work hard for his laugh there at that 2004 conference? But apart from the People's Front of Judea, the Virgin Mandy, Terry Gilliam's artwork, Graham Chapman's performance, Willis Wodger, the Giggling Guards, and a Latin lesson, what has the life of Brian done for us? Well, it's given us a song which has become nothing less than a national institution. In the early 90s, Eric Idle's song became an anthem at the nation's football terraces. It shot up the charts, bringing the unlikely sight of Eric Idle fighting through the dry ice of the top of the pop studio.
Monty Python, always look on the bright side of life.
Always look on the bright side of life.
The song has come to encapsulate a very British sort of resilience, laughing in the face of adversity. It's sung by workers on strike.
I want it at my funeral.
And it's frequently requested at the ultimate send-off.
If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten.
2 years ago in Trafalgar Square, 4,000 people broke the world record for the largest ever coconut orchestra while singing along to the song. And following on from Spamalot, which I was in, by the way, Eric Idle and John Dupre have written Not the Messiah, a mock oratorio based on the life of Brian, which has been staged at concert halls around the world.
Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. So always look on the bright side of death.
There's something wonderfully hilarious about this. It's just the idea of being cheeky and cheerful over death that is really uplifting, I think.
Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep them laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you.
You've been listening to He's Not the Messiah, He's a Very Naughty Boy, with me, Sanjeev Bhaskar. It was produced by Caroline Hughes and is a Whistledown production for BBC Radio 2.